Murph is a great kid. She's really bright, but she's been having a little trouble lately. She brought this in to show the other students the section on the lunar landings.
Yeah, that's one of my old textbooks. She always loved the pictures.
It's an old federal textbook. We've replaced them with the corrected versions.
Corrected?
Explaining how the Apollo missions were faked to bankrupt the Soviet Union.
You don't believe we went to the moon?
I believe it was a brilliant piece of propaganda that the Soviets bankrupted themselves, pouring resources into rockets and other useless machines.
Useless machines.
And if we don't want a repeat of the excess and wastefulness of the 20th century, then we need to teach our kids about this planet, not tales of leaving it.
You know, one of those useless machines they used to make was called an MRI. And if we had any of those left, the doctors would have been able to find the cyst in my wife's brain before she died instead of afterwards. And then she'd have been the one sitting there listening to this instead of me, which had been a good thing because she was always the calmer one.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm Matt Goldberg, the site's managing editor, and with me today is senior editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Today we'll be talking about Christopher Nolan and his new film, Interstellar. The film has been met with mixed reactions, and perhaps that's not too surprising. Christopher Nolan's filmography is polarizing. He is a filmmaker who has diversity in his filmography and yet returns to certain themes, certain tropes, and has a voice, which is refreshing, especially because he is perhaps the sole filmmaker who can receive a gigantic budget and use it for a movie that's not based on pre-existing material. He can use it for an original screenplay, and that's very rare. And so we look to him as sort of someone who, I think after Inception, there was the hope like, oh, maybe more people will get this freedom. No, that didn't happen at all. So it puts almost an unfair burden on his movies. And yet, for the amount of control he exercises, I think it's perhaps a fair burden. And to sort of admire his ambition, but how does that ambition pay off? But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We will talk about Interstellar. But let's go back a little bit and talk about his filmography. I will say up front that Memento is one of my all-time favorite films. I think even his debut film, Following, is excellent. It's not like Bottle Rocket, which is a film that shows promise, but Wes Anderson, I don't think, hit his groove until Rushmore. Following is just a great, small, noir thriller that is just a tremendous film and definitely worth checking out. It's not a surprise that it's in the Criterion Collection. And that was a great start. And then he goes to Memento, and then he starts moving into the studio stuff. That's when his career moves into the studio. Insomnia is, I have mixed feelings about that. And I'm monopolizing the conversation. Adam, I've been talking for a solid 2.5 minutes straight. Adam, what do you feel about Christopher Nolan?
I remember when Memento came out. This is one of those, you have like those bands that you found early and then you like watch them explode. I remember watching Memento when it first came out. I remember like scouring the internet and then downloading the manuscript of Memento Mori, Jonah Nolan's short story that it was based on, and like pouring over that. I just thought it was brilliant. I haven't seen Memento in a really long time, though. I am due for a revisit. I have not seen Following. I know it's on Netflix Instant Watch. A lot of times I've considered watching it, and I still have yet to watch it. And I really liked Insomnia. I mean, I was really looking forward to Insomnia because it was coming from the guy who did Memento. But I feel like Insomnia is a stepping stone film. That was very much Nolan saying, like, give me a studio budget. Let me show you what I can do with it. It is the only one of his films that he has not written. He's not a credited screenwriter on it. And I think that makes it kind of an outlier because it's more of a gun for hire film.
Yeah, it's also a remake.
That's another one I have not seen in a while. I do remember liking it. It kind of came on the heels of Robin Williams going dramatic and kind of seeing what he could do there. And I thought that was great. And then Batman Begins was he was an odd choice for Batman Begins. This was before the time of, you know, everyone hiring, like right now the trend is to, you know, did you make a Sundance movie? Yes. Okay, you're directing a franchise picture next. I mean, that's kind of what people do now with, you know, Jurassic World and all this stuff. But it very much felt like, you know, Warner Brothers saw what he did with Insomnia. They liked that and were like, here, have the keys to the Batman franchise. And that was interesting because I remember there wasn't a ton of anticipation surrounding Batman Begins. I may be wrong, but it wasn't.
I think there definitely was. It was sort of more of a cautious optimism.
Yeah.
I think enough time had passed since Batman and Robin. It was a reboot. I know a lot of people liked Christian Bale for Batman based on his past work. And there was good casting. People were intrigued. And I think there wasn't sort of like a fervent excitement, but people were definitely ready to go back for another Batman movie, which you couldn't have done even like 2 years after Batman and Robin. You had to give it the space.
Yeah. And again, like Nolan, this came before another trend. This was before the trend of reboots and gritty reboots. Batman Begins is the godfather of the gritty reboot. I mean, I think I mentioned in a piece I wrote recently, how many times have you heard a project compared to like, oh, it's going to be a gritty reboot in the vein of Batman Begins? But I think a lot of people didn't know what to make of it because the Batman franchise had been handled so oddly. Like I know, I mean, I was not old enough to, you know, be able to be conscious of the anticipation surrounding Tim Burton's first Batman, but I was a big fan of those movies. But then, you know, you bring in a new director and a new Batman and it just kind of felt like a series, I guess. I guess they kind of treated the franchise like Bond a little bit. There was not really much connective tissue from one film to the next. Even between Batman and Batman Returns, there's not a huge continuing story arc of
this. Oh, no, it's just Batman does a new thing.
Yeah, Batman battles Penguin in this one. So I think audiences didn't know what to expect, and I remember seeing it, and I was blown away, and I recommended it to everybody. I remember taking my dad. I was like, no, it's really good. And everyone was kind of like, really? Because like, we remember Batman and Robin. There was just no precedent for it. I don't think people were expecting that kind of superhero movie. And I really think it is the you know, the beginning of the grounded superhero trend. I mean, some people point to Bryan Singer's X-Men, but that was still like a little comic booky, not in a bad way, but it doesn't feel
It's totally comic. I mean, you go into like Cerebro and stuff. That's it's total like comic book. Like, I mean, when you know, in X2 when Magneto escapes and he's like sort of basically flying and using like that's straight out of a comic book.
Yeah.
That you could take that as panels. I think it's interesting that you sort of talk about the gritty reboot. I think Batman Begins is that to an extent, and yet if you compare it to The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, it still has stylistic flourishes that those movies don't.
Oh, yeah.
Those movies are definitely trying to be like, this is what Batman would look like in the real world, to the point where it almost seems disinterested in what Batman is up to. Whereas in Batman Begins, like if you go to the Narrows, the film takes on sort of this brown palette. With the Scarecrow stuff, you're definitely seeing trippy material. There's a point where a dude's on a, like a flaming, like, you know, nightmare horse. And so there's definitely more, it's a little bit more surreal to an extent. And yet at the same time, it's trying to also reconcile like a more grounded Bruce Wayne.
For real.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I think that's Nolan dipping his toe into the well of like, how far can I push this grounded reality? Because no one had done it before. Like, Spider-Man was a massive success, but that was very much a Sam Raimi movie. You had Ang Lee's Hulk that tried to incorporate like the pages, like the comic book pages into the screen. No one had quite cracked like, what is the comic book movie? And so I think this was Nolan saying like, you know, how dramatic can I push this? How realistic can I push it? And again, he didn't have the autonomy that he enjoys now, because obviously, you know, going from Insomnia to Batman Begins is a huge step up, because Insomnia wasn't like, you know, a giant Academy Award winner movie or a massive box office success. Like, it did fine, it was well received.
And he wasn't writing solo either. He had David Goyer, who had Blade under his belt.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that with Batman Begins, I'm with you. When I walked out of it, I loved it. And then upon further viewings and talking about it more, I still like it. The thing I love about it, my favorite thing about Batman Begins, is how it takes the standard, like, okay, mother, father, shot in the alley, and he comes sad and comes a crime fighter. What I liked about it is that it found a thematic cohesiveness by adding the element of fear. And if you look in the Batman comics, he becomes... he chooses to dress up as a bat because criminals are, quote-unquote, a cowardly lot. He wants to instill fear in them. So to use Scarecrow as a villain, to make fear the thing that drove... that is his fear, that bats scare him, and that his fear ultimately got them out of the opera early, and it had a chain effect that led to his parents' death. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
I do think the movie completely falls apart in the third act. I think Batman has very little disregard for public property of the city he's protecting. He's just going to drive recklessly through Gotham. He's going to scream at Rachel, who's under fear toxin. And then, to me, the kicker of Batman Begins is when the film starts out as his arc is, I am not an executioner. I will fight crime, but I will not kill. And then what does he do at the end of the movie? He puts Ra's al Ghul in a situation that Ra's cannot possibly escape from. He handcuffs him to a train that's about to go off the rails, and he goes, I don't have to save you, and then leaves. He gets him on a technicality, and I thought that was so poorly handled, especially you can get to the same result where Ra's could just choose to refuse Batman's help. But instead, he's like, I'm going to basically murder you. I am an executioner. And the film just doesn't really think about that. So that's one of the things that bothers me about Batman Begins. But I do think it's an interesting film. And I completely agree with you in terms of it's Nolan dipping his toe in the water to see how far he can go. And then he makes an interesting turn with The Prestige.
Yeah. I will say I disagree that it falls apart in the third act. But I do agree that he kills Ra's al Ghul. I think it's a cop out of a like, oh, technically I didn't, but I don't think it falls apart. I like Batman Begins.
Oh, but, I like it too. I have problems with the third act.
Sure. But The Prestige, I think, is the key to his entire filmography.
Yes, good talk about that. I agree.
Prestige is, and I rewatched it recently. If you watch The Prestige, you know everything you need to know about Christopher Nolan, because it's all about the illusion, and it's all about sacrifice for the sake of the illusion. And at the end, Hugh Jackman's dying words, like, you know, it's all about, gosh, what does he say? The look on their faces when you surprise them, like, it's all about the surprise. And that's what increasingly you see in Nolan's filmography is, you know, the quote unquote mind blown, you know, his attempt to continue to surprise the audience and offer them something shocking and something they weren't expecting, and, you know, something that's going to wrap them up. And I think sometimes he does that very well, and sometimes he does not.
Yeah, and I think The Prestige also incorporates other elements, such as the fascination with science and trying to blend that with magic. I love that David Bowie playing Tesla, which is great, saying, you know, science, it's not an exact science. And then there's some parts where, like, people aren't going to go along with it, like lightning clones, you know, like, but I really liked that.
Yeah.
I thought that was a cool thing, and I think the film explains it. Science is not exact science, so perhaps it is magic and we just don't understand it, but this is a thing that's happening, and that's really cool. But there's also the dead woman syndrome, which Christopher Nolan is a trope that he really goes back to. And Memento, dead wife syndrome. Yes. I said dead woman because you could also somewhat take Martha Wayne into that, but you're right. Dead wife or dead girlfriend syndrome. And there is Memento. That was the first time he'd done it, but then you see him keep coming back to it, which is it's an interesting story trope that and controversial that he keeps to, he employs repeatedly. But Prestige is really good, and I like, if we're going to talk about closing lines, I really like Michael Caine's closing line, which is, in the end, you want to be fooled.
Yeah.
And that's a great approach to cinema. And I applaud Warner Brothers for having the patience to say, we are not going to do a Batman film back-to-back. And Batman Begins did well. It did very well, but it was not explosive in the way The Dark Knight was.
No, not at all. I mean,
it was not a given.
It was a solid movie.
It is a solid movie. It did well, but it wasn't a guarantee that, you know, let's bring this guy back. And yet they were patient and let him do another movie. And then that patience paid off in the biggest way possible with The Dark Knight is a game changer.
Yeah,
it's just a game changer.
I think it's the best superhero movie ever made, and I think the reason it's so good that, like, even though the third act kind of sucks, and it goes.
See, I don't agree with the third act kind of sucks. I think the third act is interesting.
I think it's interesting, there's one set piece too many. The one with all the guys in the building and like the bat vision, the sonar or whatever that's going on. I think it's one set piece too long. I like all the Two-Face stuff. I love the stuff with Gordon and that, but I think it drones on a little long. But even with that, I still think it's the best superhero movie ever made.
I think it's too heavy in the set piece near when he goes to Hong Kong to get.
That's a minor set piece, though. That's really.
It's still like, I mean, he flies in. He fights people. He sets up the sticky bombs.
If we time both set pieces.
No, you're right. The other one is long, but here's the thing that I point to the Hong Kong one, because I think without that one, if you want to talk about timing things, it puts Batman as a supporting. Without that, he would be a supporting character in his own movie.
Yes.
It would reduce his time that much. And if you want to, David Goyer was involved in that screenplay as well, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a story by Nolan and Goyer, but its sole screenplay credit goes to Jonah Nolan, his brother.
Okay. But if you look at David Goyer's influence, I mean, look at Blade Trinity, where Blade becomes a supporting character in his own movie. And I think that's, I mean, you can even write Goyer out of the equation. I think something that if I were to look at the Batman movies from a different perspective, and when I say Batman, I'm talking about Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises, which is, for me, it's good to have Batman in your Batman movies. And yet, I think that Christopher Nolan isn't really fascinated with that character. Not as we understand Batman. What he's interested in is social constructs. That's really the thrust of those two movies. And how people react. And I don't think that Batman's completely left out of the equation. And what I like about the third act, and or especially the ending of The Dark Knight, is that Batman is a fascist. Batman and Gordon decide to be fascists. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that they're fascists because they decide, even though the people have proven that they are trustworthy and that they can handle tough decisions, that they cannot be trusted because Harvey Dent killed some people. He went crazy, understandably crazy. Like, no one be like, man, he just really just woke up on the wrong side of the bed and went and murdered some people. His girlfriend died and half of him was blown away. So I think people would be like, yeah, that's bad. But we don't need this notion like we need a white knight to protect Gotham. It's sort of Batman and Gordon overreaching on their power. And I thought that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. Well, and, you know, Batman becomes a supporting character in his own movie. You could say that. But who can blame them when you have a performance like Heath Ledger as the Joker? Like, it is tremendous. And,
it
like,
is.
You
want, it really
you
is.
Want it to be. It's I would call it a co-lead. And, you know, so little about the character and yet so much just through Ledger's performance. And I remember watching it for the first time when he breaks into the gala or whatever and starts explaining how he got his scars. And I was like, that's kind of lame. I mean, they got to explain it. That's a dumb story. And I was like, I wish I hadn't known that. And then he keeps changing it. And I was like, oh, yes. I was so excited.
Which is totally in tune with the joke. Like, a criticism I've heard about The Dark Knight is like, that's not the Joker. That's like, and actually it is. It's a new spin on the Joker, but with elements pulled from the comics, such as the Joker, you know, they call him insane. He's like, no, I'm not. And if you look at I forget who wrote it. Morrison. He wrote Batman Arkham Asylum, this book, and in it they basically says that the Joker has a form of super sanity, which leads him to do these atrocious acts. And then there's also the fact of the Joker, for God bless him, decades and decades, still really doesn't have a set origin story. And so the fact that he does changing it,
because I've seen that fucking Martha and Wayne and the Pearls so many times.
I am glad that Batman. I'm just glad that Batman v Superman has no fucking reason to show that.
Yeah, I'm so tired of it.
Everyone fucking knows it.
Yeah, it should just be like, you know, Like, you know, that's why when I watched the Gotham pilot, I was like, we're going to go here, really? We got to do this.
Other than that, I hear Gotham's great.
It's fun. I enjoy it. It's silly. It's so silly.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But it's fun.
But it's something where, again, it's a game changer because at this point he's like, no, it's going to be real. And it looks like, you know, we're in Chicago. And that's where Gotham City, like in previous Batman movie, Burton and Schumacher is like, no, I'm going to give Gotham is basically going to be a character in the movie.
Yeah.
And Nolan isn't really interested in that. He's interested in how the people within Gotham behave and how that gives the city its identity. But from a visual standpoint, it's not really distinct as something that you'd see in a comic book.
Well, and they changed it for all three movies, right? The Batman.
Yeah, because the third one was shot in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and the first.
And now it looks like it's in Pittsburgh.
Now it's in Detroit.
Yeah.
Superman.
Exactly. So we'll see how that all pans out.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a fascinating film, and here's the thing. I'm not ignoring the issues that it has, and yet I have so much fun with that film. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
So there's that.
And
then
follow that up.
Again, credit to Warner Brothers. They said, now at that point, they're fucking salivating.
Yeah.
Give us a sequel. And the deal, the trade-off is, you let me make Inception, which is a trippy film that's not really easy to explain in one sentence.
No.
And then I'll give you The Dark Knight Rises. And I remember when Inception first was announced, and the log line is a thriller. Like, I think it was like a thriller that takes place in the architecture of the mind.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck does that even mean?
Yeah.
But I was like fascinated. And it's just,
in the pitch meeting. Like, I imagine it's like the South Park episode where it's like, and then this level, and you go down to this level, this level.
Right, exactly. And I wish that Inception had been a game changer like The Dark Knight was. But it's really hard to... Studios like doing emulation. They don't know how to recreate quality, but they know how to recreate a formula, which is why you see all this crossover shit now because of the Avengers.
Yeah.
But
well, with Inception, it's
what's
like,
the
sure.
formula for Inception? It has none.
Yeah, and also, like, sure, it's a great movie. It's a great original movie, but you got to throw $160 million at it. Like, who's going to gamble $160 million on another original idea? It's just, it's so tough for studios to make that kind of bet.
Yeah, and he still had to earn it. He had to be, like, from the director of The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to put it on there.
And I will say there's the...
And then you give it, like, an amazing cast, and you're on your way.
That cast is incredible. And even, I don't really like Marion Cotillard that much, but I, you know, even with her in there, I still think it's a really fantastic ensemble. And I will say, I know the Dead Wife Syndrome is latched onto Nolan, but for Inception... Mall was originally the partner. And so, you know, Inception was a story that Nolan had been working on for years. Like, this is a script that he had been, like, toiling away on for, I think, like a decade, somewhere around there. And he couldn't crack it. And once he offered the lead to Leo DiCaprio, he was like, yeah, but I need an emotional pull. Like, we need something here. And so it was Leo, actually, who, with Nolan, helped create the wife character. It was like, because originally Nolan had created it as his partner. I mean, obviously the structure completely changed after they changed it to the wife. Like, it's not going to be like, you know, he goes back in to save his partner. But I think that Nolan had tried to do something not with the Dead Wife Syndrome, and then it was like, oh, but what if it's a dead wife? Oh, that works better.
Exactly. I think it definitely works better for the narrative of the film. It gives it more of an emotional grounding. And I think one of the ways you know Inception worked well is that, I mean, it totally hit the cult. Like, people, it's like, you have to see Inception.
Yeah.
You have to see it. And it became talked about and became parodied and became discussed. It really was something, because it is a good film, but even people who didn't like it, like, it was great having that conversation with them. And even, like, on the nitpicky points, it's like, why doesn't Michael Caine just bring his kids to him? What's the issue here? Of course, then you can go into the whole argument that the entire movie is a dream.
Yeah.
That, however, I take issue with that reading, because there are scenes that take place outside of Cobb's perspective that he couldn't have knowledge of, like when Ellen Page and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are making when she shows him a totem,
yeah,
and she's learning from him. Like, why? That's where it gets fuzzy. You know, yeah. That's where I do the squint. That's where I do the Leo squint.
Well, and one of the things I also really liked about it too, and this goes back to the Prestige, is I remember seeing in trailers, and then you see the movie, and you're like, how did they shoot that scene with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like in the hotel hallway? And Nolan didn't release the footage for the longest time. It was one of those things where you don't want to know how the magic trick is pulled off, and they eventually did, but I still don't think there's a ton of footage of. It's probably on the Blu-ray.
I mean, there's photo of the basically the rooms like on a spinning rig.
Sure, yeah, but that wasn't. It was one of in a lot of movies they kind of start touting that stuff in featurettes of kind of like it's cutting edge technology, but it was kind of like no, you won't know how it's done. And even when they released that, it was still like, okay, but how did they have him pushing the huddled bodies into the elevator and all that craziness?
Yeah. So, and he also, that's another credit to Nolan. He really likes practical effects.
Oh yeah,
he
puts a premium on those. He's bringing back miniatures.
Yes, which is something I wish Peter Jackson had taken note of when he was doing miniatures for the original Lord of the Rings thing, and now he's like, whee!
The Hobbit for Best Animated Film.
The Hobbit for Best Animated Film. And so that's the thing. Like, Nolan is doing things, and then, of course, there's IMAX. We would be remiss if we didn't mention how he increasingly uses IMAX to and eschews 3D. He rejects 3D. Mm-hmm. And, again, you wish that he could be that game changer in more ways than just The Dark Knight is gritty. Like, sort of, James Cameron was like, now we'll all make 3D movies because I made $1 billion. And
technically, he was right. It's just domestic audiences aren't seeing them in 3D anymore. Worldwide,
no,
sure.
Worldwide, for sure. Well, we saw them from 2009 to 2011 or 2012. We were like, okay, there was still that the Avatar effect.
Yeah.
And then it dropped off. But you're right. Overseas now, 3D is driving it, and it's just a shame that it had to be 3D instead of IMAX.
Yeah.
Because I find IMAX an infinitely more immersive experience.
Yeah. I would like to ask Cameron, be like, would you still have touted 3D if you knew it was going to turn out this way, where everything is post-converted and no one in the U.S. is watching 3D movies?
Well,
this is kind of like what he wrought. Like, this,
right.
It's kind of
now
his
let's,
deal.
Let's be fair. 3D is easier to do as a experience. IMAX is tough.
Yes.
That's something, the cameras are very loud and they're hard to maneuver. So usually if you are watching an IMAX film and you notice the changing in perspectives, the non-IMAX perspective usually comes in dialogue scenes,
yeah.
Which granted don't need to be in IMAX, but there's a reason that the aspect ratio keeps changing.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do, unless you're making some a documentary about Mount Everest, you can't really do an entire movie in IMAX.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. And there are dialogue scenes in IMAX, but all of it has to be ADR'd. You can't
yeah,
use
Yeah, seriously, ADR'd. And even then, sometimes, as we've seen with the opening of The Dark Knight Rises, ADR'd again.
Yeah.
I like how that's the thing. The Nolan camp is very, very protective and defiant, and they sort of get to do what they want. And so when people call them out on the Dark Knight Rises preview footage of the opening, and people say, I can't understand what the fuck Bane is saying. They're like, no, yes, you can. It's fine. We're not going to change it. And then, of course, they totally changed it.
Yeah. Well, after all the Interstellar sound mix issues, a friend of mine recently tweeted, he said, I seriously think Chris Nolan might be deaf.
That could seriously be the fucking case. It's possible. I mean, that's something. I'm glad that other people noticed an Interstellar sound mix issue, because I thought when I saw it in IMAX, oh, it's just my crappy theater. But then I saw it in 70mm, where it was only slightly better, especially at the end of the movie, where there's music and there's dialogue and there's sound. And it's just like, I can't understand what the closing lines of dialogue are in this movie.
Sure.
That's a problem. We're not at Interstellar yet, so... Then we go from Inception to Dark Knight Rises, and this is where trouble starts happening.
Yes.
Dark Knight Rises is a... I wasn't crazy about it the first time. I watched it again, about a year and a half later. It is a bad movie.
Yeah. I've seen it three times now. It is far and away his worst movie.
Yeah. It is not just... What we're talking about, there are films it's my least favorite, you know? No, this is his Cars 2.
Yeah.
And
what's frustrating is there are some good parts of it. Like, Anne Hathaway's Catwoman is fantastic.
Yep, that's
true. There's some good stuff. The villain,
Bane is a memorable character, but he's not a good character.
Yeah, the main problems are the villain sucks and the turns. Again, this is where you start seeing Nolan's magic trick philosophy starts running afoul. Like the Talia al Ghul turn, just it's just unnecessary, and you can see it coming a mile away, and it's not interesting.
It's yeah, it doesn't really change. It doesn't provide any depth or thematic resonance.
Nothing.
And at this point, Batman really does become a supporting character in his own movie.
Yeah, like
the movie has no idea what to do with him.
Yeah.
It starts from an interesting place. It does start from like 8 years later. He's basically defeated, and this is the last stand, I guess, of Batman. That he's basically nothing really belongs to him anymore, and that his quest will end in futility. Except the third act is such a junk pile of how did. Nothing really changes for Batman. It's just, it's not really well thought out. And again, when we get to Interstellar, we'll see that Christopher Nolan, he has an attention to detail on technical effects, but story-wise, he's really starting to lose the thread of what does this world look like? Because he's thrown into the pit, which is quoted, hell on earth, but they have fucking satellite television where he can watch what's happening in Gotham. Just like, okay, well, I have TV. How bad can things be? He's not really taken away from anything. He basically finds a replacement Alfred/chiropractor in Hell on Earth. And how is he going to beat Bane? Bane kicks his ass. Well, what's the secret to beating Bane? I know. I'll do more push-ups. That was his big thing. I'm just going to work out some more. He didn't learn anything. He didn't learn some weakness or some truth. Other than, oh shit, the rope, you don't want to do it with the rope, you have to do it without the rope. Okay, I get it. That isn't really that rewarding.
Leap of faith. Take a leap of faith.
Take a leap of faith, whatever that means.
Dependent man shall pass.
Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, he gets out of the well, and then it's like, and he's going to get back to Gotham really fast.
Yeah.
Really, really fast.
Like,
unnecessarily. Unnecessarily. You set the rules of the time bomb. So you could give him as much time as you needed narratively for him to reasonably show up. And then what does he do? We're on a ticking clock, and then Batman is going to paint, make sure, again, the dude has zero respect for Gotham property. He's going to take the time to make sure his logo is right, to get sure the logo, and to everyone let him know, I'm back, Batman's back. And then it's just, I talked to this guy one time who believes that the ending of the film is a dream sequel, like that Batman really does die, but it doesn't hold up because there's a scene where Lucius Fox is like, the autopilot was fixed, and you don't drop that in there if you, like, A, you don't drop that in there if you don't want, if it's unnecessary to A, leave that as a mystery anyway. B, nothing in the Batman movies imply dream sequences. Everything in the Batman movies happen. So to throw that in there just doesn't work with everything, the other 6 hours of five or whatever we've seen so far. It just doesn't gel. And then, of course, you have Batman as an egalitarian notion, which is completely at odds with Batman Begins, which is weird because Dark Knight Rises is meant to tie back into Batman Begins. And the whole point of Batman Begins is like, oh shit, you have to train really hard to be Batman. It's not easy, but this notion where they literally say in The Dark Knight Rises, anyone could have been Batman. No, not anyone. And in fact, when you say that, it makes me realize how they didn't catch on to Bruce Wayne being Batman, because the dude with the fucking huge car tank and the plane and all this, you know, action figure stuff, who could afford it? Because again, you're dwelling in realism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what does that say? And it was misguided repeatedly. And Dark Knight Rises is something where no one's going to tell Nolan no. And that's when things get problematic.
Yeah,
that's,
I think,
where
we
it
see
gets
that time and time again with other
with directors.
As well.
Yeah,
yeah. It's just, it's when you get to the point where it's just, there's no pushback, which means there's no, I mean, there are so many filmmakers and so many creative types who say that some of their best story ideas, some of their best work comes out of being creatively restricted and saying, like, no, you can't have that. No, you have this budget. This is what you have to work with. Look at Looper. Look at what Rian Johnson was able to do on a small budget and sci-fi, on an original sci-fi movie with Looper. That is incredible, and that has a small budget.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that when you look at the transition from Lord of the Rings, which is Peter Jackson still an unknown quantity, that's a dude who, I mean, those movies cost a lot of money, but he's a dude where
Relatively speaking, though, each movie was, I want to say, $75 million. I mean, obviously, there were reshoots and pickups done after the fact.
Well, they, I mean, still expensive for their time.
Yeah, yeah.
Expensive for their time and doing things that perhaps, you know, again, he hadn't hit the level of success where he felt invincible. And then when you start seeing, and then when you see King Kong, you're like, this doesn't bode well. And then it all goes to shit with Lovely Bones. Yeah. It all goes to shit.
Yeah.
So you're hoping that that doesn't happen with Nolan and his career, because I'm seeing shades of it again with Interstellar. And this is our point in our conversation where we arrive at Interstellar.
Finally.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. He's had a career. Adam, what are your thoughts on Interstellar?
This is a... My first reaction when I came out of the movie, I said, that's definitely a movie. Probably too much movie. It's an odd film. I'm mixed on it. There are parts of it that I really like. There are parts of it that I really don't like. It's one of those movies where you find yourself thinking, like, is this garbage or is it a masterpiece? Like, I'm not sure. I can't really decide.
Well, let me ask you this, because it's something I've also heard with Interstellar more than other movies, are people, like, really kind of upset that critics talked about it so much? Like, a lot of people are like, you influenced my opinion, or, like, I, like, Twitter.
No,
like,
I was actually kind of thankful to have seen the critical response going in, because, okay, so if you look at Nolan's filmography, obviously Dark Knight was incredible. Expectations for Inception were very different than expectations for Interstellar. Inception was, you know, it's the same guy who did The Dark Knight, which is incredible, and Batman Begins, which is good, and Prestige, which is really good, and Memento. But Inception, like, is a weird movie, you know, and it's an original concept. So I think there was a little bit more apprehension there. I mean, obviously, clearly people were excited for it, but it was kind of like, I'm not
but
really
sure. But it's
like,
oh, this is an original thing, and I don't know what to expect from an original thing.
Yeah,
hold me.
I don't know what to expect. With Interstellar, Nolan has now been deemed god of all things, and there's like a cult following for him, like, not cult in the fact that it's small, but cult in the fact that, like, worshiping at his feet.
Fervent.
And so expectations for Interstellar were like, it wasn't like a, oh, here comes an original movie, this will be interesting. It was, oh, here comes an original sci-fi epic from Christopher Nolan, it's going to be the best thing that's ever happened in the history of movies. Like, expectations were,
it's going
so
to rival
high.
It's already drawing comparisons to 2001,
yeah,
and Close Encounters, Spielberg also worked on this, and oh, what does that mean?
Yeah, and this is a project that I had been tracking for years, because when I remember when hearing that Spielberg became attached, I was like, this sounds great. And with Jonathan Nolan writing the script, I was really excited for it. And so expectations were insanely high, and so in that way, I was kind of thankful that the critical reaction was mixed, because that lowered my expectations. I wasn't going in saying, like, all right, time to be blown away off the face of the planet. I was like, let's see what this is. Like, I don't know where I'm going to fall on this one. And I'm mixed on it. I am disappointed. I guess I came out somewhat disappointed. It's too long. It's too much.
It has a 45-minute prologue.
Yeah, Nolan put so much movie into this. And, I mean, the same could be said for 2001, which is also a lot of movie, but it's 2001 is abstract, whereas this is just, it's not as intellectually stimulating.
And yet, for a 45-minute prologue, this world is still vaguely defined.
Yeah, the world building is not good.
It's something where you're raising more questions than you're answering, and you're not even at your sci-fi level. You're not really reaching your trippy levels yet in terms of, you know, people from another dimension and time dilation. You're not even there yet. What you're at is wait. So we are now in a world where laptops are contemporary. We still have regular laptops. And yet we are now also in a world where standardized textbooks say the moon landing didn't happen, which means the internet must be fucking gone.
Yeah, it was just, it's really...
How far in the future do you have to be to say that this could be in a textbook?
It's...
I mean, I understand that, like, there are certain things that are like, I get it. Like, you know, there's some textbooks like Intelligent Design, Teach the Controversy. But to say, like, you'd be hard-pressed to find a standardized textbook, a textbook that, like, across the nation says, evolution didn't happen. just didn't happen. It's a myth.
Yeah.
That would be like this. That would be like saying the moon landing didn't happen. It's a good piece of propaganda. And that point serves Nolan's point about, you know, we used to look to the stars. By the way, that's another problem I have with this movie, is I think the dialogue can be incredibly stilted. Like, there, the conversation between McConaughey and Lithgow on the porch sounds like the prelude to a car commercial. It's like, we used to look to the stars, and now we look down in the dirt.
Yeah.
And it's like, now I drive my Ford F-150, and it's a weird kind of, it's borderline he forgot how people talk.
I never caught on to that. That never bothered me. I thought the dialogue was fine. I just think that Nolan had a bunch of ideas that he was juggling, and he was unable to reconcile what kind of movie he wanted to make. I mean, it's clear that the heart of this movie is a father-daughter story, and that's fine. But then, you know, he veers off into other directions for a while. Like, it also wants to be this big sci-fi epic, which is fine. But I don't think he successfully blended the two in a way that was satisfying for the audience. Like it's totally fine if you want to say that textbooks say that NASA didn't exist. Like, I buy it, but... explaining more,
but you have to build something around it. That's
what
thing.
I'm saying
you
is
have
I
have to build
I
around
don't
it.
Understand it. Like, I will buy it, but I don't understand it, because you have not established this world yet. Like, you're showing, I understand he wants it to be intimate, so he wants to stay on this farm. You don't want to go macro with it, which is fine, but I don't think the world building is there for you to understand what kind of world they live in yet.
Or there's just certain things that you wonder the specifics of, in terms of, look at the hugeness of this mission. You have to save the human race. That's it. You're not going to save it. You just need to save humanity. Okay, I'm going to send 4 people.
Yeah.
4 people. Say what you will about Armageddon. They sent 2 freaking shuttles packed with as many people as they could get. And then they added people later. They added Peter Stormare.
Yeah.
They put more people on their shuttle to try to make up for the fact that not all of them are going to make it. And so when you have 4 people, that seems to undermine your world-saving mission just a bit.
Well, to
for
be
me.
Fair, they had sent 12 before, but again, it's just not clear.
But on solo
missions, the clarity isn't there. Like, it's not, it's unclear. And also, it goes from like them being like, do you have any interest in piloting this? I can't tell you anymore until you say yes. And he says yes, and it cut to blasting off in the space shuttle. Like,
well, and the other thing is, and then I wonder, they did say, like, we had people testing in a simulator.
Sure.
But I'm wondering about the other pilot who has given up all family connections to devote his life to this one mission. And they're like, no, it's okay. We got this farmer to do it.
Yeah, farmer guy.
We got this farmer today to do it. And he's just a good pilot. He's just the best. But yeah. Thanks, Jerry. We appreciate the time you put in. Can I go as a back, as like a co-pilot? No. Only 4 chairs. We could only fit in 4 chairs. So, thanks
well,
anyway.
And honestly, and okay, we're going to get into spoilers now. So if you have not seen Interstellar, thank you for listening. Go see the movie and come back when you've seen it. But I imagine a lot of people saw it. It did well at the box office. And if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably been following along. But if for some reason you haven't seen Interstellar, stop listening now. So I was with the movie. I never got bored. Didn't get particularly, you know, upset or perturbed about anything until Dr. Mann came in. And that was one turn too many. I was like, really? We're going to go down this road? Why? Why is this necessary? Like, I get it, you know, man, it's a pun. I understand what you're doing. But when it turned into just, you know, I'm a crazy coward and I just want to get off. It just felt like one more set, like the Prestige. Like, he is trying so hard. Like, the movie, it's not enough for the movie to be visually and emotionally stimulating. It also has to be surprising in another way.
And you also see how the Nolans are so good at controlling marketing campaigns, because I'm sure there are people at Warner Bros. Like, we gotta fucking tell people Matt Damon is in this movie.
Yeah.
In a pretty significant role. And I'm glad they kept him under wraps, because if you let people know that Matt Damon is in this movie, they're gonna keep waiting for Matt Damon to show up.
Sure. Well, and I
it takes
he was
a while.
In this movie. We wrote up the casting a year ago.
No, we knew.
Yeah.
We knew, but like, that's the thing. But I don't think general audience
because
he's not on the poster, and that's what I'm saying. Like, when I saw it a second time in 70mm, and the crowd, like, I heard people like, what? Is he, like, Matt Damon's in there? How did I miss that? And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That you could hide that.
That was cool.
But
I was sitting there waiting. I was like, okay, either Matt Damon is one of these guys that's on the last two planets, or he's an alien.
Or he's the voice of the, I thought for a second, because he kind of sounds a little like Bill Irwin. And I thought he was like, oh, he's the voice of TARS. Okay, that's where he comes in. Okay.
I was hoping we'd see Alien Matt Damon.
Alien Matt Damon? Yeah. That'd be great. Yeah, so it's... that turn, to me, it's like... It is something where it's almost like we're trying to get to another action scene.
Yeah, it was just kind of...
And I like that action scene, though. I really like when he tries getting... When he basically spins the ship to get onto the spinning shuttle. Like, he has the ship and he's trying to spin it to get back on. That's really cool, and that's really well put together. But to get there... Also, I don't understand why the one robot self-destructs to blow up poor Romilly. Like, what was the purpose? It's like, I can't understand, have anyone, you know, understand my data. So just blow it up before. Like, why did you booby trap your robot?
I don't know.
We have to kill the black guy, of course.
Yeah.
We can't have him make it to the end.
Yeah. I have a lot of questions. I want to see it again to see either if stuff just didn't make sense or if it
doesn't make sense.
I heard otherwise. Chris Tapley said he saw it a second time and a lot of it crystallized for him. So
yeah,
I'm just curious to see if my opinion changes on a second viewing, knowing where it goes.
I'm not going to dissuade people from second viewing. I saw it a second time and I felt about the exact same about it. I feel the problem is when you skimp on world building and you draw archetypes and don't really flesh out character. I think McConaughey does an amazing job.
Oh, he's
fantastic. He is doing a lot with a little.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff I like, but I think McConaughey is fantastic. I really like Hathaway. People seem to not like Hathaway. I don't know why, but I thought she did a fantastic job. The scene with her in the spaceship, her monologue about love was really interesting to me, and it just goes nowhere. Like, he does nothing with it.
I mean, I think what he does with it is he reduces love to a calculation.
Yeah,
he's like, I can communicate through my daughter because I love her. And it's like, as long as we find the formula for love, we're going to be golden. And I just feel like, you know, that's a very nice sentiment, but in execution, what I'm seeing and trying to withhold snickering is when I see him communicating with Murph, and I'm just getting this notion of, like, my tiny astronaut daddy came from the fifth dimension to tell me how to save humanity. It's just like, this is not working. This is something where you are going for a big sci-fi idea, and I love the design of it.
Oh, yeah.
I love the design of the Tesseract. That is so cool. Visually, magnificent. Narratively, kind of silly.
It makes no sense that Jessica Chastain would be standing there and going, like, of course, it's been my dad all along. Like, what tells her that? I want to know what impetus, like, lets her know that that was her dad. Like, I had figured it out a while before. Like, so it wasn't as shocking to me. I was like, oh, you know, he's the one that sends the message back in time. I didn't know how he would do it, but he would do it. But it makes no sense to me that she would just, like, be up there, you know, looking at stuff and be like, of course.
Because she's brilliant and can therefore do anything.
Okay, this is a father-daughter story. They spend the entire movie wanting to be back together. They spend 2 minutes together when he comes back, and it's like, oh, you know, you don't want to watch your daughter die. Bye! I'm gonna be with my own family. Go find Anne Hathaway's character.
Steal a spaceship. It's really easy to steal spaceships.
Supposedly, I read an interview with Jonathan Nolan recently that went into spoilers, and he says that the wormhole closes when McConaughey comes back. So he is technically setting off to go and find her again, not knowing how he's going to get there.
Yeah, and a tiny spaceship, by the way. This one doesn't apparently have a suspended animation capsule. So by the time his spaceship arrives, you'll see a McConaughey corpse say hi to Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
Wherever she is, you know.
But, like, how does Brand mean more to him than spending the rest of the time that his daughter has left with his daughter?
I think he would have gotten over it. I mean, they spent so much time apart. It does feel like a very off moment to have the old Murph shuttle him away. And I think I will say, though, there have been some people that it's like, it teaches, you know, that abandoning your child is good. I don't think he abandoned her.
No.
When I say when I hear abandoned, the connotation is selfish, that I did it for me.
Yeah.
So, secondly, it's not like, so he didn't want to. That wasn't the thing. And then, also, I don't think the fact that, like, it worked out that I left you, it's just, this is the way it was meant to be. I think that gives Murph, it sort of shortchanges her, because he isn't really the hero. She is. She's the one who has to put it all together.
Yeah.
And he said, again, that is told to us directly. There's a lot in this film that is told to us directly. Well, we are treated as a fairly stupid audience in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard the argument that, like, oh, Inception, it's so complicated, it's going to blow your mind. It's really
not. It's not complicated.
No,
it's very straightforward.
The rules are explained very clearly over and over again. You know exactly where you are. And it also has to do with good filmmaking. Like,
excellent. And excellent editing.
Yeah, in Inception, you know exactly where you are, exactly what's happening. And I think in Interstellar, to some degree, it's not as cohesive, just kind of the visual, like, space of, like, all right, where is this in relation to this? But I thought the visuals were really good. The use of miniatures was interesting. It's not as awe-inspiring as something like Gravity, which is where I think the like CG versus practical debate becomes interesting, because Gravity is essentially an animated feature, whereas Interstellar, Nolan used miniatures to, like, most of the ship stuff is miniatures, and I think it looks good, but not as kind of mind-blowing as something like Gravity. And I also, is this just me, or were some scenes out of focus? Some of the film scenes.
Yes, especially the close-ups on McConaughey. Like,
he
looks blurry.
The close-ups of the people on their deathbeds were out of
focus. Well, that was kind of blurry, but even like when McConaughey is on the porch talking to Lithgow,
yeah,
there's like this close-up, and like his face looks like stretched out. Like, yeah, it looks like it's kind of, it's in the very early stages of Jacob's laddering. Like,
yeah,
it's just,
well, and it's not Hoyt Van Hoytema took over as cinematographer, and like he's done incredible work on like Her and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but those were Tinker Tailor might have been film, but I know Her was digital. But I am curious. I mean, I don't know
how would it have been with Wally Pfister.
No, I'm curious if how it would have been on digital, because like the IMAX cameras are giving a resolution that's closer to digital as opposed to the 35 millimeter cameras.
True.
And I'm curious to see, is it because I haven't seen a movie shot on film for so long that it looks blurry to me? Or
it looks, like, I mean, I saw it in digital IMAX and I saw it in 70 millimeter.
Yeah, so did
I. It looks this. So you, well, okay, but I'm saying that I've seen it two ways and it looked the same both ways.
Yeah, yeah. But it just, my question is that, like, was it really out of focus, or is that what film looks like now? Like, I don't know. I was kind of taken aback by that, because it was like, this movie is, it's almost kind of ugly in some parts. And Nolan is such a stickler for visuals and all that stuff. It's not a very good looking movie.
It can be beautiful at times and then very like kind of crummy in others, and not intentionally. Like the scene I keep referencing, the Lithgow McConaughey scene. Oh, it's because they're on Earth and they're miserable. But then the scene where when McConaughey is watching the videos.
Yeah.
Again, it's like, it's kind of
the
like
resolution
a little.
Isn't great.
The resolution's not great. It's
that scene is fantastic though. I think that
emotionally, it's fantastic. Like, I don't really care about the like that point. That scene is just.
And that's
one
what
of the
I'm saying is that
films,
it's frustrating that like this isn't Dark Knight Rises. This is not a bad movie with like a capital B. I think there are parts of it that are really good, and I think that's one of the parts that really works. That like, you know, as soon as they get down on that planet with the time shift, they're going to come back and it's going to be later. So you know what's going to happen, but it doesn't change the fact that it's so emotionally affecting when it does happen. And I think that's a testament to McConaughey's performance, and also the way Nolan edits all that together.
And I would say, you know, give a hat tip to David Yassi.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, like, it's a very subtle thing, but I love it when they show, and it's not just like he's got gray in his beard, but he's like rubbing his hands because he has arthritis now.
Yeah.
And like,
I was a little surprised that he didn't have like jars of piss everywhere and wasn't like, you know, talking to a beach ball or something.
That would have been great.
Years.
That, well, he spent some of it in suspended animation. Some of it.
Some.
But he seemed, here's the thing, he seemed like a pretty even keel dude.
Yeah, that's true.
And I assume he got over his fear of space travel.
Yes, yes. And the set pieces in this thing are really good. And it did not, in some ways, it's incredibly predictable. Like, I knew the minute it opens with the frame story of Ellen Burstyn, I was like, oh, got it. Dad saves the world. Daughter, you know, also saves the world. And she's telling
And that was
the
such a weird framing device that's just abruptly dropped.
It was.
The,
it, I don't think it's
the survivor.
I mean, it's used in the museum videos. It's
no,
the,
but like I'm saying, as a narrative, like we see those videos directly. We see them once at the very beginning of the movie, and then about maybe 20 or so minutes in, we see another couple survive clips from the survivor videos, and then they're never seen again.
Yeah, you're right.
Never seen again.
I think it's really interesting
until you get to the museum and we see where they came from, which I didn't really care, but
yeah, right, they're in the museum. I agree that the execution isn't great, but I think it's a really, really fascinating idea, which I think it does a good job of kind of putting us in the place of, I think just using elderly actors like that, it's a really interesting way to tell a sci-fi story.
It's a great sci-fi. I agree. I just wish it had been used consistently and more effectively.
Yeah.
It's a great idea that's not fully developed.
Well, and speaking of consistency, I think a lot of the emotionality of Murph, of the Murph Cooper storyline is lost due to the fact that you have three different actresses playing Murph, which is the, I mean, that,
you got to Benjamin Button that shit.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That was always Fincher's issue with Benjamin Button, was like, you can't do it with different actors. You're not going to have the emotional through line. He was like, what if we turn Brad Pitt into an old guy? But it was, some of it was lost on me. And all three performances are great. I think Mackenzie Foy is really good. Jessica Chastain's not in the movie near enough to kind of, it just seems not a
to
waste
really
of
leave
talent.
An impression.
Yeah, it's not a waste of talent, but just kind of I wish I could have seen more of that. And that's like, what's Topher Grace doing here?
Showing up
kind of out of nowhere.
Showing up.
Yeah, just showing up. Just
yeah.
Just
before
there.
I didn't mention this in my review, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention it now. I did love the robots, and they're practical.
Oh yeah,
which is so cool.
Yeah, I liked the robots, and I think this is Hans Zimmer's best score with Christopher Nolan ever. I think
interesting. It's a surprising score. I liked it. It's a toss up. I really like the Inception score.
The thing that bugs me about Inception is that he's ripping off his own Thin Red Line score.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you.
It's the same thing. It's the same
thing. But I don't like. I maybe it's because I like Inception more than Thin Red Line, and I just the way it's used, I find it. I get more emotion from it. But that's fine.
It's such a majestic score in Interstellar.
It is. It's a great, and it's unexpected. Fantastic. It's unexpected. I will say that. It was more in a higher. I'm not good at describing music as well as I'd like to be. Register. It's not boom. It's not in the heavy bass. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry. It's not. It doesn't feel like. It feels like Hans Zimmer, but not in a self-parody sign
of way. More it's melodic than a lot of.
Yes, music. Melodic. Thank you. Thank you, words.
He hasn't done one of those in a while. Though I really love his Rush score, which I think is underrated. I thought that was fantastic.
So that's the thing about Interstellar. I love the ambition of it, and I love that he can go for it. The film is a success. It's not, I don't know if it'll be Inception success. It is getting people talking, which is good. It's always good that a film's starting a conversation. I think, however, that conversation will dissipate very, very quickly in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see. Like, the opening weekend really didn't mean much to about the
I was surprised that Big Hero 6 did so well, and very happy about it. I liked that movie a lot.
I wasn't. I mean, that one was kind of expected, because it was the, you know, the boy-centered animated movie. There hasn't been...
Yeah, but still, I mean, it's... I mean, you have... Interstellar was just... I felt the marketing saturation on Interstellar was much heavier.
Sure,
and
it was. It is a surprising box office performance, and not in a good way. It made less than Inception opening weekend,
but it made more than Gravity.
More than Gravity, yeah. Less than 2012 did on the same weekend a few years ago. So it's interesting. Not a bomb by any means, but I'm very curious to see what the repeat business is on this.
Yeah, the legs are going to be interesting, especially because it's so fucking long.
Yeah, my initial reaction when I saw the movie, I was like, I don't know if I ever need to see that again, because it's so much. It's such a commitment.
It was definitely, yeah.
Because not all of it works, so you know you're going to go back and sit through long stretches that are just kind of like, eh.
Yeah, it does. You can feel it. Like, Inception's a long movie, and you don't feel that it's long.
Yeah.
It's really propulsive. But Dark Knight Rises and that's my fear, and this is my fear about Nolan. This is the fear of self-indulgence. So I don't know where he goes next, but I will say, it's going all the way back to the beginning of his filmography. It's disappointing, I think, in a sense, when you see directors like Peter Jackson and Christopher Nolan, and this notion that I now make big movies all the time.
Yeah.
That's my thing. I'm in the studio system, and I'm going to make blockbusters. And this thing that I can't go back and make a smaller movie, like, it just kind of gets forgotten.
Yeah,
because
Nolan was directly asked if he would consider doing another smaller movie, and his answer was essentially, why should I? Like, I, while I have the opportunity to make these big movies, he feels that he can blend in the same themes that he would explore in a smaller movie on a grand scale. And which I understand to some degree, like, while you have that clout, use it. I mean, it's kind of one of those, it doesn't last forever kind of things. And if you're able to, I mean, he is the only director right now that is able to go to Warner Brothers and say, I'm making this for $150 million. And they're like, okay, Spielberg can't do that. Spielberg turned down all the time. Like, he cannot get his movies
financed.
Which
is so fucked up.
It's really, it's really, really disparaging. Scorsese can't get his movies financed.
And seriously fucked up.
Yeah, and nothing against Nolan. I mean, I think he's earned it. Like,
he's earned it, and he's found a way to blend big ideas and his craft in a way that will respond to a wide audience.
Yeah, and it makes sense. And so, I'm curious to see where he goes from here. I don't know if I would like to. I will say I would like to see another sci-fi film from him, because I think that he has good. What's the word? I think he has good instincts when it comes to sci-fi. Not necessarily the execution of it isn't all there, but I admire the ambition. I really did not. I thought it was going to end with him going in the black hole. I did not think we were going to go into this fifth dimensional space and go into all that, which it was a little confusing in the fact that, like, wait, so are there aliens, or like are we just evolved humans and that stuff? But I like that he went there.
Yes.
That said, it did feel very. Very derivative at times of 2001.
Yes, I agree. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes next, and because how much freedom will he have to go there, or does he have to do another One for You movie? Does he have to go back? Do you think he has to go back to the well, or is he now free? Batman Begins again.
No, I think he's free. I think
Aquaman. He'll do Aquaman.
Well, I will say, I guess it depends on the box office. And he was able to bring Interstellar in under budget, and he locked picture in like June or July. Like, he was done with this months ago, which is apparently his MO. He's like the Clint Eastwood on a grand scale. He
one take and done.
Yeah, he comes in on time and under budget. He finished this one, I think, early and then under budget. I think he came in like $10 million under what Warner Brothers gave him. So, and that's another thing that speaks to his autonomy, is that, like, if he's doing these things very economically, like, if he's not wasting, like, he's not Aaron Sorkin-ing it, where it's like, hey, you know, the script pages were due 2 days ago and the cast is getting paid to sit here. It's done. And so I think that makes it easier for Warner Brothers to say yes. Where, well, Interstellar was a Paramount picture, but Warner Brothers got on the train.
Really, like, we need to get a piece of this.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, we will give you this, this, and this if you give us the international. They're like, okay.
Okay.
I am curious to see, because where do you think he goes from here? Because he's been doing big movies, but he's done superhero, sci-fi. I guess Inception is technically sci-fi. What do you think he does next?
That's tough to say. I don't see him doing... I think whatever he does will still remain in sort of a clinical fashion. I don't see Christopher Nolan doing a fantasy movie. I see him doing something that retains sort of his cold style. So sci-fi would not be so surprising, but I think if he does... It's interesting. I mean, he's done different dimensions. He's done dreams.
Yeah.
He's done space. Where do you go from there? And I don't know. It's tough to say, because he's not like a David Fincher who's like, I'll attach my name to everything and see what happens.
Yeah.
He is very meticulous and precise. And
he says, this is what I'm doing next.
This is what, and I'm sure there's plenty of things he has in his mind, but he doesn't share them in public.
Yeah. I wonder if he does like a war picture, something like something that's not, that's in like, 100% grounded in reality, something that he can do on a big scale, but also because Interstellar really was and I mean, this is a complaint that's been lobbed against Fincher as well, as you know, everyone complained that Nolan was too emotionally cold, like his films didn't really have that center.
You know what he could do?
What
he could do Bond 25.
Oh, that would be cool.
Because he said, I wanted to do a Bond. He said in the past he wants to do a Bond film.
Yeah, but what did he say? He would want to start over with a new actor so that he would be able to not
to craft it
in
from
some...
there.
Yeah.
Sure.
That would be,
but I can see a spy film from. That's what I'm saying. I think Nolan could do a spy film very well.
That's a good idea. I agree. Because I think Interstellar was his attempt to rectify the emotionality, and I don't think he got it. I don't think this was a home run.
I think it was too calculated.
Yeah, too calculated. I think his reach exceeded his grasp. But
yeah.
Again, admirable.
I'm glad that he can reach.
Yeah, I hate saying A for effort, but really, this one does get points for effort because
yeah,
it goes to places that a lot of people would be too scared to go.
I agree. I think we've about covered it. I think we're good. Let's go to recommendations. Adam, what do you got for us?
I am recommending another sci-fi film that has to do with the end of the world, and it is Danny Boyle's 2007 film Sunshine. This one is a bit divisive, not unlike Interstellar. If you are not familiar with Sunshine, it takes place in the year 2057. The Earth is again in peril, this time from a dying sun. And so a team of astronauts are sent to essentially shoot a nuclear bomb into the sun in order to restart it. But this is it's a really, really interesting sci-fi film in that it's very atmospheric, a little esoteric. And then it turns into a slasher film, which I'm not crazy about.
Yeah, the third... I love Sunshine up until the third act.
Yeah, and that's the thing. But I still think it's worth... I still think it's worthwhile, despite that. And I still think some aspects of the third act work. And it's a really interesting film. And one of the things I love about it is that it features an international cast. Because if the Earth was in peril, it's not like America's going up there to save everybody. You know, we're all in this together. They're not just going to send, you know... only Americans. And so the cast of Sunshine includes Cillian Murphy, Nolan collaborator, frequent collaborator, Chris Evans, Rose Byrne, Michelle Yeoh, Cliff Curtis, Troy Garrity, Hiroyuki Sanada, Benedict Wong, and Chipo Chung. And it is it's kind of a scary movie. I would categorize it as like a sci-fi / horror film a little bit.
Yeah,
it's written by Alex Garland, who also wrote Never Let Me Go, which I like a lot, Dread, which I'm not crazy about, and he his directorial debut is Ex Machina, which looks really interesting, coming up with Oscar Isaac. He's also attached to direct an adaptation of a book called Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer that I liked a lot. But back to Sunshine, it's really interesting, and I think it's kind of a good companion piece to Interstellar, because it seems like they're kind of cut from the same cloth, and that they both are heavily influenced by 2001, but they take the influence in completely different directions. And I like Danny Boyle a lot. I was the one person who liked Trance, and so I don't know if it's just me, but I really enjoy Sunshine, and I even enjoy parts of the third act. But despite all that, I still think it's definitely worthwhile, and definitely worth seeking out if you haven't seen it. Or even worth a rewatch. So if you haven't seen it, I recommend Sunshine.
Sunshine was one of my... as I was watching, like, this could be one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah.
This could be... And then it hits the third act, and it's like, no!
It's
what the... Why are they fighting Blur villain?
And I think Interstellar is kind of the same way, in that there's, like, the Dr. Man turn is... It kind of, you know, separates the men from the boys. I mean, figuratively, not... literally. But I think that's either you go with that turn and you love the movie, or you are not with it and it just kind of starts going downhill.
Yeah. My recommendation is a short film that kind of blew up, a viral hit, called Too Many Cooks. don't start singing it, you son of a bitch. And so Adult Swim has been doing, for a little while now, they take a block of an infomercial, like at 4 a.m. when infomercials are running, and then they'll sneak in a short film to mess with insomniacs, which is fucked up. But what they'll do is, so they'll have this, and what they slipped in recently was this 11-minute short called Too Many Cooks by a guy named Casper Kelly. And it starts off like, it's a parody of like 80, like it kind of starts off like a parody of like a Full House sitcom, you know? It's like, you know, someone's name comes up, they turn to the camera and they smile, and then, you know, and then it keeps going and going and going and becomes this weird sort of free association train of thought, dream logic nightmare that's still fucking hilarious. And it's so much fun. But I will say, this is not everyone's sense of humor. It is not something that's like, if you don't like Too Many Cooks, you know, you don't know. Like, this is very specific. But if you were like, if you like the work of like Don Hertzfeldt, and I'm not saying any more specifics on Too Many Cooks, because part of what makes it so much fun is the discovery and like, where the shit is this going to go next? But it's only 11 minutes, and it is glorious. So I am recommending Too Many Cooks, which you can watch for free online right now. There will be I will embed the video in this article because people should watch it. Okay, that's our show. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
It's Adam Chitwood.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.